Welcome to On the Money, where you can find out anything and everything to do with finance, business, and the economy. On the Money is broadcast live from the studios of Radio 2SER 107.3 nationwide over the Community Radio Network. I'm Roderick Chambers, and coming up on the program this week...
I think what Consumer Data Right is actually doing is a fundamental shift into really progressing digitisation.
The ACCC policy, the Consumer Data Right, is being implemented in the banking industry. And while it opens up numerous opportunities, especially for fintech industries or fintech companies, how much of our personal information is going to be available to these financial institutions, and what does it mean for us consumers? Also on the program...
But it's a compound. It's essentially not jumping into a lift in the morning and having 20 other faces staring back at you and not knowing who's got what. You know, it's privacy, it's the ability to have your own compound and be self-sufficient to a certain extent.
Many people have been working at home with COVID restrictions, and some of them quite like it. This has prompted many to think of permanently working from home, but in a more rural setting. You'll be surprised when what the tree changers are looking at to move to. Stay tuned for all of this and more coming up on The Money. But first, the announcement of the imposition of China's so-called security law is confirmation that they will take over all of Hong Kong's institutions and it will be the end of Hong Kong as we know it. All the words dating back to even earlier than the British-China negotiations in 1984 have proved to be meaningless, a sop to the gullible West. They're going to take Hong Kong by force if necessary. I asked Dr. Graham Smith, a fellow from ANU's Department of Public Affairs, how many refugees we might be getting from Hong Kong.
We have seen a real uptick in refugee applications. And as you can imagine, Hong Kong, being a wealthier place in Australia, is not somewhere we generally get refugee applications from. But I think they'll mostly be under a different visa class.
There's still a lot of people that have ties with Hong Kong that are ethnic Chinese, though, aren't there?
There's a huge number of people, Australian citizens. I think it's 100,000 Australian citizens currently in Hong Kong. So direct ties are there, and we have a very big Hong Kong community here in Australia.
Just walk us through what's happened with the changes in the laws. It sounds like it's the end of Hong Kong as we know it. Is that your assessment?
Yeah, that's a fair assessment. It's a huge change. I mean, it's almost the biggest change since 1842 in terms of the sovereignty of Hong Kong. It really now is, at the discretion of the Chinese Communist Party, who goes to jail and who doesn't. So it's a massive change. The laws themselves cover four basic crimes, all of which are very loosely defined. So secession, subversion, terrorism, and collusion with foreign forces. So these can all be stretched to mean practically anything, particularly the last one. So even someone talking to me and me saying something negative about Hong Kong, is that collusion with foreign forces? It's very arbitrary, it seems.
Well, I think that's a point that Secretary of State Mike Pompeo was making, wasn't it? That it really is the Monroe Doctrine of China.
Yeah, and it has a very interesting clause that surprised a few people. It's extraterritorial. If you stretch it, possibly what I'm doing right now is also against the national security law. And should I, decide to transit through Hong Kong, maybe someone might pull me aside and have a little word. That was, I think, one surprise in the legislation. I don't think there were too many other surprises. Otherwise, it's pretty well as grim as everyone had expected.
Do you think perhaps that might have been directed at Taiwan?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, Taiwan is front and centre of this. So this is an extremely bold red line that's now been drawn as far as the sovereignty of Hong Kong goes. And next on the agenda is the reunification. People have, I think, given up on peaceful reunification. No one's really talking about that in Taiwan anymore. But yes, it's a very strong message to Taiwan.
I noticed that the US sailed a couple of warships through the straits there between Taiwan and China during the commemoration of Tiananmen Square. Did they have a bit of a pre-warning of this, do you think?
Look, all of these things are, I think, generally known about in advance so that, you know, things don't go wrong and we don't have a horrible accident in the Straits. So no, I do think there would have been forewarning of that. Militaries aren't quite that reckless these days.
Is the UK going to take the lead in taking people from Hong Kong, or do you think we'll end up getting quite a lot of people?
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting. Australia's come to this a little bit slowly, and I think in some ways because the UK has said to us, look, there could be a lot of people applying. It's 2.9 million people have a category of visa called British National Overseas or BNO passport. And in theory, under Boris Johnson, what Boris Johnson has said is they have a pathway to British citizenship. Now, it's unlikely that all of those people will take them up. But given we're in a downturn, I think Dominic Raab turned to us and said, look, you might be required to help out here.
Business in Hong Kong's had a pretty rocky run for at least the past year. How is this going to affect business in Hong Kong?
Look, I mean, the people who are in favour of the legislation are saying this is just what we need. We've had turmoil for the last year or so, you know, rioting in the streets, etc. And this will provide a bit of certainty to business. But the nature of this law is such that it really does limit what companies can do and what companies' employees can do. Because we've had targeting of, for example, the employees of Cathay Pacific who took part in the demonstrations. So from a corporate point of view, the drop in the stock exchange as soon as this was announced was a fairly clear signal that not everyone in the business community is sold that this is a good package.
So the agreement that was made, one country, two systems, the basic law, the 50 years of serene sailing towards complete integration with the Chinese nation, that's all been laid a bit bare, hasn't it? Really, it was all a lie.
Well, I mean, the way China explains it now is that the agreement was negotiated at the time from a position of weakness and that China is no longer in a position of weakness, so it won't be abiding by the agreement, which is quite extraordinary. Up till now, they'd sort of stuck by the rhetoric. And if you look at some of the rhetoric of Deng Xiaoping back in the day, he saw it in a very different way, or at least sold it in a very different way, to say, you know, if 50 years passes and China hasn't moved towards democracy, then we'll wait another 50 years. So the idea was that China would catch up with Hong Kong rather than Hong Kong becoming China.
But doesn't that sort of mean that don't worry about what we say in any agreement, just count how many guns we have?
Yeah, so this is really a key point, is it undermines China's credibility in international agreements. You know, whether they say, look, we were a different China back then, people will say, well, look, it's still the same People's Republic of China. It's still the same Communist Party. You should be sticking by your agreement. And they were initially arguing that they had, but now, you know, that's dropped away in the last few days.
And we've seen skirmishes on the Chinese-Indian border, the uptick in rhetoric against Taiwan. The South China Sea, again, has been bubbling away and every now and again in headlines. Is this all really a plan that China has in place?
Look, I don't know that you would call it a plan. I think you'd just call it a much more assertive and aggressive China under Xi Jinping. Certainly the government of Xi Jinping is doing things that the previous government would never have considered entering into. And the number of countries that China's had a falling out with, I mean, we see ourselves as doing pretty poorly, but, you know, if you compare us to the US or to Canada or even to India, as you said, you know, we're actually bubbling along not too badly. And it's, you know, this is a very interesting situation because China talks about the complexity and the risks of the international situation, but at the same time adds to the complexity and the risk of the international situation. So it's a, you know, it's hard to work out exactly what they're doing. It doesn't seem to be a great plan.
Well, it sounds like we just should forget what they're saying and just look at the guns.
Well, that seems to be what you know, our government announced the other day. So
yeah. And just from the announcement the other day, do you think that the hardware that we're looking at getting and the changes to our airfield in Northern Territory is going to make any difference?
China itself, Zhao Lijian, the rather bullish spokesman for their foreign ministry, took it in his stride, surprisingly. He didn't have anything particularly negative to say about it. And I think he understands that this has been in the planning for a while. But yes, certainly it's a signal both that we need to look after ourselves and that we can't rely on America anymore. And I think in that respect, it's probably a realistic approach.
Dr. Graeme Smith, Fellow, Department of Pacific Affairs and the Coral Bell School of Asia Pacific Affairs at the Australian National University, speaking with me there. And I'm Roderick Chambers, and you're listening to On the Money throughout Australia on the Community Radio Network. No,
doesn't make sense to me. If your dollars don't make sense, listen to On the Money.
Banking sector is the first to be introduced to the consumer data right, giving consumers the ability to share financial information across organisations. So what is open banking and how is it going to affect you? Alfred Cho asked Tony Thrasis, Chief Information Officer at fintech company Frollo, about open banking.
Open banking is based on the consumer data right that's been introduced by the ACCC and the government. So consumer data right allows consumers to give consent to access their data from their banking partner. Open banking is the first implementation of that. It's banking is the first industry. So consumer data right is broader than open banking. Open banking is more an industry term and the first part of open banking into banks.
How is it different to traditional banking?
Today, a consumer has their bank accounts with a particular one or more banks, and those bank accounts, if they want to allow other people to access their accounts to provide a service like Frollo, they actually have to provide their internet banking ID and password. But with open banking or consumer data right, that's no longer required. What will happen is they will consent to allowing data retrieval to occur. So it's through this consent mechanism, which is the major change.
And what kind of customer data would companies like Frollo be looking to gain access to?
It's account data, such as their balances, type and name of account, and transaction data. We talk about enriching it, which is really just understanding what type of transaction is it. Is it a transfer? Is it a bill? Is it an expense on lifestyle? Is it a living expense? So we're able to look at the transaction and interpret what that money is being spent on and then allocate it to particular buckets, if you like.
What are some of the standards and rules and regulations Frollo needs to follow in order to be able to use customer data safely?
So no fintech or no one else can actually access data through the consumer data right without being accredited. And that accreditation, it relies on 13 different data safeguards that ensure that the data that we retrieve is not being misused. It's only being used for the purpose that has been that we've requested or sought consent for. That data cannot be seen by people inside the company, except if there's a need to do so or a legal need to do so.
Much of the focus is using customer data to leverage more competitive, personalised banking products. How does that translate into direct benefits for consumers?
Consumers are facing a bit of a lazy tax. It's a tax on them because they don't shift their bank accounts easily. They don't take the opportunity to get better products that are out there. And the purpose of this is to more enable that. So the purpose of the consumer data right is to give people access to new products and to enable them to be able to take up those new products without paying that lazy tax penalty or that loyalty. I mean, one example would be people take on these new types of savings accounts that pay bonus interest rates, but we can actually see that very few customers achieve those bonus interest rates because they're not actually depositing their five deposits or making withdrawals, the number of withdrawals that are needed. And by not doing so, they miss out on their bonus interest. Because we can see the transactions and we know what type of product they're on, through this product reference data. We're able to give them an SMS, an email, a nudge in our app that says, hey, you know, your month is nearly ending, but you'll miss out on your bonus interest rate if you don't make another deposit.
And going back to privacy concerns, does opting into open banking mean your data is always available for any kind of situation?
You opt in to an accredited data recipient. So when a consumer gives consent, they're giving consent to an accredited data recipient. They're giving consent to one person to retrieve a scope of data that is defined. So we as a fintech, we need to define and tell the consumer in the consent what type of data we're retrieving, and we need to say for how long. Consent can't be given for longer than a year. Consent can be given for shorter periods. It can be given for 3 months, 6 months, 9 months, for instance. And then if the consent expires, we have to delete the consumer's data. We can't hold on to it, which is another one of the privacy safeguards. So consent is for a specific person to retrieve data from a specific bank for a specific period of time.
You said there was a scope set out for the kind of data that Frollo would be able to retrieve. I mean, that's the same as a social media company like Facebook setting out that it's going to collect a certain amount of data in those really long terms and conditions boxes. Is Frollo going to have something similar, or is it going to be a lot clearer for customers to see?
The consumer data rights has CX guidelines and CX standards that ensure, and I can tell you that clearly, and the consumers actually, they need to, in our consent flow, to select the data that they're agreeing to be seen. And it comes in clusters. The CDR actually defines what the data clusters are, things like account balance and things like transaction. So it's very direct. It's not it's not defaulted. The user needs to make that selection. They need to toggle the switch that says, yes, you can get my account balance, and toggle the switch that says, yes, you can get my transactions. And it's very apparent. And we also then provide a statement that says, this is what you agreed to. And they can see it in their dashboard. So they can always go into the dashboard of the app and see what they've consented to. And they can withdraw at any time. So they could go into the dashboard of the app and say, okay, I've given you a consent for 6 months. I can see what I've consented to, the actual data that I've consented to, and for which bank. But I am now withdrawing that. I'm withdrawing that consent. And our obligation is within 24 hours, we will have deleted that data.
I think part of the concern is that tailored banking products don't necessarily mean they'll be tailored to better suit the customer. So how does this just differ from banks being able to access even more personal information about customers to carefully manage who gets what products at what rates?
So this is more in the hands of the consumer. The consumer can take up services like from Frollo to help them as a fintech, or from other accredited data recipients that will access the data from the bank.
Where do you see open banking going in the future, and how does Frollo tie into all this?
So Scott Farrell is undertaking a review. So the government has initiated a review of consumer data right with a view to looking at what things need to be done in the future. One of the big things, and one of the big things that was done in the UK, is what is called right access. And what the UK is seeing is that right access is actually turbocharging the take-up, really progressing digitisation, and that's a good thing.
Tony Thrasis, Chief Information Officer at Frollo, speaking with Alfred Cho about open banking.
You're listening to On The Money, where smart money listens right around Australia.
New research shows that COVID lockdown has convinced many people that they can work from home. This has led to a number of people to consider moving to the country and to telecommute, but as long as they're within striking distance of the city office. This area has been called the Golden Circle. I asked researcher and CEO of Ripehouse Advisory, Jacob Field, to explain how his research has found this golden circle.
I guess the research we have conducted has revealed what we're calling a new golden circle that we feel is set to emerge around, you know, Sydney, Melbourne, the other larger capital cities in the wake of COVID-19, and how COVID-19 is impacting how we live and who comes into the country and who moves around different parts of the country. So we feel this golden circle is, you know, caused by people moving further afield from population centres, potentially in search of lifestyle, you know, sea and tree changes. These emerging outer areas are expected to see much higher population growth than previously forecast.
And what are some of the characteristics of these areas that people are finding attractive?
Yeah, probably need to clarify, you know, employers are potentially embracing working from home models, and with many even potentially encouraging workers to continue working from home even as restrictions ease. So these areas that they're moving to offering a lot of lifestyle benefits. They still are in commutable distance. If they're only having to go into the office once or twice a week, then suddenly a 2 or even a 3 hour commute is feasible. You know, so they're moving to these areas that offer space. They offer the ability to have a larger floor plan with a veggie patch, potentially a home office that they can broadcast and they can have their Zoom meetings on. But it's a compound. It's essentially not jumping into a lift in the morning and having 20 other faces staring back at you and not knowing who's got what. You know, it's privacy. It's the ability to have your own compound and be self-sufficient to a certain extent.
But, of course, that relies upon a certain personality type. And we have seen the results of people being locked up recently where they have gone a bit stir-crazy, haven't we?
Yeah, I would agree. And I it would only be a certain component of the population that would, you know, up and move. We have seen, you know, case studies already starting to emerge where people were umming and ahhing prior to COVID, and this has been the straw that's broken the camel's back. This is now where they've gone, all right, let's do it. We've been thinking, you know, one reason or another, let's change our lifestyle, and this has been the push over the ledge for them. So part of the research did look at changes or the propensity of people to favour sea and tree changes. But on the other side of the research, we looked at overseas migration and turning the dial down on that for the next 18 to 24 months. How is that going to be impacting population growth? So there's definitely two sides to this coin. One of them is, you know, sea and tree changes, intra and interstate migration is set to change and certain areas set to benefit, but other areas potentially are going to be potentially impacted on the negative side by turning the international migration dial down.
And, well, you'd have to say then that's primarily Sydney and Melbourne, wouldn't you? Because that's where a lot of the immigrants come into.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So we're seeing the LGAs of Parramatta, Strathfield, in and around the Burwood areas. They're heavily reliant on overseas migration to, I guess, form the population forecasts that are sitting there when you'd go and look up the city of Parramatta at ABS. The population figures sitting there are heavily reliant on this overseas migration. And when you turn that dial down, I mean, our bullish scenario is that we'll have a travel bubble open up with New Zealand and potentially other countries, including Taiwan, South Korea, Japan, Canada. When you've got 100% overseas migration turned down to 15 or 18%, assuming that we're only receiving international travellers from those locations, suddenly population forecasts get a little bit shaky for these areas that are heavily reliant on that international migration to form population growth.
You're in the lovely Apple Isle in Tasmania. There is that's been in the headlines with varying real estate problems. I suppose a good problem in a way, in that there's been high demand in Hobart, particularly. What's going to happen there?
We've had a 5-year bull run. You know, we've had an upwards, you know, peak or cycle for a number of years, and it's been really brought on by a combination of the sea and tree changes. We call them the mainlanders are invading. You know, they're coming down here for the lifestyle reasons, setting up in Melbourne and Sydney and buying a beautiful big mansion here or a large land allotment and setting themselves up. You've got international students. The university down here is very successful at attracting international students. And tourism is going, you know, gangbusters with the Mona Museum, etc. So we're seeing, when you turn the international migration down a few notches and tourism down a few notches, at least in the shorter term, Hobart is potentially a little bit shaky. The backbone of what has been driving that prolonged growth cycle, if you remove two large components of that, things might be of concern. Having said that, in our projections, we are turning the dial up on the interstate migration. So mainlanders, Sydney, Melbourne, coming down here to live. when you turn that dial up, it's in many cases cancelling each other out. So we are seeing on a national level, many parts of Hobart and surrounds and regionals, you're losing on one side of the coin, but you're gaining on the other. It's a break even. Cities of Sorel, City of Clarence are standouts for us to really benefit from that interstate migration.
If they're for some odd reason not considering Tasmania, what are their big options at the moment?
The big winners for us were around the Hunter region all the way up to Armidale. So in some particular Muswellbrook, as an example, as a local government area, we saw dramatic increases in our three-year population forecasts. That LGA actually led the whole country at 21% extra population growth in the next 3 years. All the way up to Armidale had a 6% increase over those 3 years. Also down into the Southern Highlands, down into Kiama, set the benefit. Surprisingly, when we were beginning the research, we all have a gut feel, obviously, and we have our opinion. I was thinking it was going to be the Wollongongs and Newcastles, the Katoombas, who were set to really benefit. But it was that ring further out, as I mentioned before, the 2.5 to 3 hours suddenly becomes acceptable if you're only commuting to the office once a week.
Jacob Field, CEO at Ripe House Advisory, speaking with me there. This is On The Money.
And that's it for us on the Money this week. Tune in again next week to find out everything you need to know about finance, business and the economy. Thanks to our producer Alfred Cho this week. On the Money is produced in the studios of Radio 2SER for the Community Radio Network and with the assistance of the Community Broadcasting Foundation. You can find all of our shows and stories at 2ser.com/onthemoney. Subscribe to our podcast. New episodes are coming out all the time. Follow us on Twitter. Look for @onthemoney2ser and find us on Facebook and Instagram as well. I'm Roderick Chambers. We're going to be back again next week to give you the inside running on all things financial. Thanks for your company and stay well.